If you've been told to pull up your socks, then make sure it's a pair of TNT socks. The TNT shop is now open at TNTradio.live. Good company and civilized debate with a premium on fun. Ross Cameron on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Well, good day, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, wherever you are on this beautiful spherical object Carl Sagan described as a little blue dot. It's a pleasure to have your company. My name's Ross Cameron, coincidentally appearing for the first time on the Ross Cameron Show, slightly immodestly named. Some would say that I have many reasons to be modest, but like Narcissus, who looked into the river and fell in love with his own reflection, we are all at risk of losing perspective, most particularly on ourselves. And this is one of the objectives, I suppose, of the Ross Cameron Show. Is to maintain perspective. And we might say that throughout history, one of the great questions has been, how do we know what we know? One of the great preoccupations of philosophy is not just what we know, but how do we know what we know? And I am a little bit inclined to begin, since we have what John Locke described as the tabula rasa, the blank page, tonight, you and I. It may be just Mum and me, I'm not sure. Hoping Mark Latham will join us shortly, and perhaps Nigel Farage after that. But for the moment, it's a good question. I think it's an enduring question. It's still, if you like, an unanswered question, how we know what we know. But if we go back to Socrates, my recollection could be faulty, but I think the legend was that a tripod had been recovered from by a group of fishermen, and it had a special significance, and they wished to present it to the wisest man in the world, certainly in their Mediterranean world. And they went to the oracle at Delphi and said, is Socrates the wisest man? And the oracle, with uncharacteristic frankness, said, yes, Socrates is the wisest. So they went to give it to Socrates. And he was rather startled and modestly sought to refuse the tripod. And the reason he said, was he went around and sought to find a range of other people who might be wiser than him. But he said the reason was all I know is that I know nothing. And I just want to say that on the tabula rasa, the blank page of the first Ross Cameron Show on TNT Radio, that I don't really come to you with the answers, but I think more often with the questions. And that indeed is the Socratic method. And this idea that we begin from a blank page found an echo almost 2,000 years later in the person of René Descartes, who is the creator, the inventor of Cartesian geometry. And Descartes likewise was a Catholic by tradition, French, yet he went on this journey. He became dissatisfied with what we might call the accepted wisdom, with the dogma of his time. And he said, I want to know for myself, like Thomas wanted to put his hand into the side of Christ and satisfy himself that the bloke was dead. And so he said, I want to evacuate my brain of every inherited assumption, and I want to build up whatever might be called a useful, even scientific knowledge based on facts about which I have no doubt. And in order to do that, I need to evacuate my brain and my mind of every inherited prejudice and assumption and start from nothing. And so we sort of follow in the same tradition that the Ross Cameron Show is very attracted to evidence, attracted to facts. And a fact is something we regard as a piece of data that is verifiable. It is not a mere assertion. We think assertions and opinions, indeed, have their own merits and values, but they are not facts and should not be asserted as facts. So, for example, when I see today the Treasurer of New South Wales, Matt Keehan, announcing $1.5 billion for batteries and wind farms, because he says it is needed to invest in the transition to the carbon-free economy. This word transition is used quite frequently, but I see no evidence for the existence of a transition. I see the destruction of an energy grid, but I don't see it actually coming out on the other side with a functional municipal power grid. And that's just, if we like, one example. And so we prefer to sit down in a question like that and ask ourselves, from an engineering standpoint, we had the discovery and invention of electricity, or the harnessing of electricity, some two centuries ago. And we know what is required for a municipal power grid to deliver electricity to the socket of, for example, roughly 8 million people in New South Wales. And yet I find that there is an ideological commitment to what is described as, quote, transition, which has absolutely no correlation to the requirements of a municipal power grid, in particular its ability to produce baseload power, which requires inertia, which requires absolutely reliable, stable platform in the generation sector. And that which we have enjoyed for several decades is in a process of destruction. And today's announcement by Matt Keane for the people of New South Wales, I regard as simply one more step. But in every issue, we just want to begin this journey together, where I want to say to TNT Radio Live, who invited me, perhaps in a moment of momentary lapse of judgment, to host this show, I said to them, well, what subjects are off limits? Because my last couple of experiences in media, both television, radio and online, was that there were a very large range of subjects which were off limits, whether because of sponsor relationships or the general zeitgeist or the particular preferences of the owners. The requirement to participate was actually built largely on what you would not say, on the guests you would not invite, on the questions you would not ask. Yet I found in TNT radio this very refreshing breeze of openness, of reason. And TNT said to me, well, we expect you to be factual. We expect you, if you wish to criticise someone, to allow them a right of reply. But we place no editorial limit on the subjects you may discuss. And I thought that was a refreshing and admirable approach. And I thought that alone was enough to provoke in me some sense of obligation to occupy the seat and to invite you and a number of my friends to join me. It's been, for me, a beautiful day today. I will just tell you, it's just a bit of gossip. I'm sitting drinking a gin and tonic. I'm going to give a shout out to my former landlady, Tracy Griff, who taught me the art of a really nice gin and tonic, which she said requires a very nice glass, a nice gin, a good tonic, a plentiful supply of ice, and fresh lime in abundance. So to Tracy, I have taken your advice, acted on your tutelage. I have returned from a swim this afternoon at Bondi Beach. And I can tell you that Bondi Beach at 5 o'clock on a balmy Sydney summer Sunday afternoon is pretty close to paradise. The water was crystal clear. The sun was shining. One could feel the invigorating effect of the salt water and the sunlight creating a factory of vitamin D. I'm not sure that the morality mullahs of Tehran would have endorsed the dress code. But I will say to my friend, one of my closest friends and collaborators, Navid, who is an emigre from Tehran, who at the height of lockdown made the remark to me as he watched a business being destroyed. He said, look, I fled the mullahs of Tehran, but I'm coming to prefer them to the mullahs of Macquarie Street. And it was hard for me to argue. But we are going to Macquarie Street after this first break, when I will have very great pleasure in inviting as the first guest on the Ross Cameron Show, the Honourable Mark Latham, MLC, One Nation member, lead of two members in the New South Wales Upper House. He's running in the election, which comes to New South Wales on the 25th of March. And I regard him, I have to confess, I'm a Liberal Democrat myself. We have an excellent Member of Parliament in Victoria in the person of David Limbrick. But pound for pound over the last several years, Mark Latham has been Australia's highest value Member of Parliament. So you will have that treat to look forward to when we come back right after this break.
TNT Radio's Steve Hook.
Does it seem like this administration has just completely jumped the shark in so many ways? It seems as if each and every day that goes by, this administration is losing more credibility. Not that they had any to begin with, certainly not from my perspective, but it's gotten worse. The border's still wide open. We're now shooting down balloons or what? We don't even know what we're shooting down. We just know we're shooting stuff down. Overreaction to the original spy balloon. No doubt. And of course, now we've got trains exploding in Ohio with carcinogen liquids that are now a controlled burn. While they tell everybody, oh, it's fine, it's fine. Animals are dropping dead. Fish are floating up in rivers and creeks and streams and lakes all around. I've been watching it lately. Pete Buttigieg, Mayor Pete, has been completely MIA on this, as he has been MIA on everything. But it's just so par for the course for this administration.
Steve Hook on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
A deadly virus emanating from Wuhan, China, is sweeping across the globe.
Something is off.
The disease caused by the novel coronavirus has been titled COVID-19.
What we're being told doesn't add up.
It's so important in this crisis that we're in.
Congress passes a multi-billion-dollar bill that will bring...
There is no cure, no way to treat this illness. All we can do is wait for a vaccine.
All we can do is wait for a vaccine.
There must be a doctor out there who's questioning this.
I'm Dr. Peter McCullough. I'm the Vice Chairman of Internal Medicine.
The only chance to reduce the risks of hospitalization is early home treatment. We can beat this pandemic.
Patients actually think the virus is untreatable. There's such a focus on the vaccine. Where's the focus on people sick right now?
The pressure to suppress any hope of treatment is extraordinary.
Why the single-minded focus on the vaccine? What is that? What is that about?
That's really going to be the goal of investigative reporters to figure this out.
Unprecedented lockdowns. Devastating economic damage, huge violations of personal freedom, families separated from their loved ones, all in the name of a medical emergency.
Things won't go back to truly normal until we have a vaccine that we've gotten out to the entire world.
The hope we have of protecting our communities is to get a needle in every arm.
I am not going to follow what you are suggesting and let the virus slaughter my patients.
John, I'm watching what's happening. This is a treatable illness.
I don't think this is a matter of academic debate and confusion. What the evidence shows is that this is an organized criminal enterprise. They call this a business opportunity.
People need to know the truth.
We are witnessing the greatest organized crime in history, to the tune of trillions of dollars.
The biopharmaceutical complex is using censorship, propaganda, and manipulation to keep people living in fear. But what we need now is courage.
The Courage to Face COVID-19. Available at CourageToFaceCOVID.com.
The issues that matter to you and questioning the facts. Ross Cameron on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Well, g'day. Welcome back. It's Ross Cameron on The Ross Cameron Show, Ross Cameron Live. It's all about Ross Cameron, so they say. I've got my very first guest, and I should make a disclosure that I have, for my sins in a former life, been elected the president of the New South Wales Liberal Democrats, which is one of the three sort of leading minor freedom parties. We are running a candidate in, indeed candidates in lower and upper house seats in the coming elections. Yet we have an enormous degree of regard and respect for the party, which is really our big brother, which has been substantially more electorally successful, both in the federal and state parliaments. And its leader in the New South Wales upper house is Mark Latham. He has, in a slightly interesting little shimmy, actually resigned from his position since he's already a member and is recontesting with a suite of other candidates. I also want to say before I, well, firstly, Mark, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ross. It's great to be on the Ross Cameron program, and I wish you all the best for every success. This sounds like a great new venture.
Well, thank you, sir. That remains to be seen. But I do want to say, indeed, Mark and I have previously had a media collaboration, and it was for until we each successively got sacked, a very successful collaboration. And I have to confess, it was Mark's idea, and it grew out of Mark's recognition of a moment where Mark was one of three people who correctly predicted the election of Donald Trump as president of the United States in 2016. And the three of us who sort of shared that accolade joined forces at Mark's suggestion. And I just wanted to say thank you, sir. You did me a favour. I enjoyed it. And it's great to be back on air with you, at least for the moment.
Yeah, well, Ross, that program is still going quite successfully on Sky News, called Outsiders. And the original three outsiders were yourself, myself, and Rowan Dean. But I'm proud to say that I only lasted a couple of months on the show, because to prove that you're the true outsider, you needed to get cancelled, using today's language, to get sacked. So I was the first to go, and then you were the next to go, and Rowan, of course, is the great survivor. And all of us in various media formats, I suppose sadly enough, have outlasted the Trump presidency, which was curtailed by COVID and other problems in the United States. But as an outsider, we continue to buck the orthodoxy, to campaign against the woke, the wealthy elites, the teals, anyone who looks down their nose at working people and departs from evidence and common sense in the public debate, well, as outsiders, we're on their case.
Tell me, while we touch on that subject, It looked there for a while like Trump had been pretty well knocked out of contention, yet seemingly has stormed back in. And I understand Nikki Haley, who's former, I think, US ambassador to the UN, perhaps a governor of somewhere, doesn't really inspire me that much, is indicating she's back in the race. But we've essentially got two bulls in the paddock in Ron DeSantis and Donald Trump. Does the Honourable Mark Latham want to express an opinion on whom he prefers out of those two?
Well, they're very fine candidates, and certainly the Republicans have got better people to pick from than the Democrats, who are stuck with sleepy, senile Joe Biden and seemingly no one of any quality to take over from him. And he's a real low point in the history of the American presidency. I like DeSantis. I love that slogan of his that he wants Florida to be a case to be a state where woke comes to die. I have appropriated it for New South Wales. I want New South Wales to be a state where woke comes to die. But Trump, of course, is the ultimate fighter of the small L liberal establishment in the United States. And I first found appeal in Donald Trump for his non-interventionist foreign policy back in the days when you and I were in the federal parliament. I worked out early on that the adventurism into Iraq would be a disaster. Trump supported that. And in the 4 years he was president, he's one of the very few who didn't start military conflict. So he's kept his people out of disputes, warfare in the Middle East. He's kept their national treasure, their domestic money domestic to look after infrastructure and I suppose their COVID response, which ultimately killed off his presidency. But the fact that he was a president for peace globally was very important. And his critique of NATO in the context of the Ukraine was spot on and stands today as an uncorrected analysis of what's gone wrong in Europe.
Well, we have to, you know, if we're being fair and balanced, as we aim to be, we have to say that the Nobel Committee has been entirely corrupted, along with many other once great institutions, in that they would give Al Gore a Nobel for making a video, but not give Donald Trump one for the Abraham Accords.
Well, didn't they give Obama a Nobel Prize when he'd been about 3 weeks in office?
Yes, I think he'd only been in for a couple of days.
So they throw those things around. But Trump, of course, is ineligible given the woke nature of that committee. Yeah. But I think Trump's work in the Middle East, Trump's work in his critique of NATO and building the non-interventionist foreign policy credentials of the Republican Party has been pretty important. And he's probably established something of a general consensus about a new type of foreign policy in the US that I think stands up well over time. So he had domestic achievements, he had international achievements, and I think stylistically remains an inspiration to us as a straight talker, a fighter, someone who, you know, in Australian language would call a spade and then whack his opponents over the head with it. So we love Trump for being honest. And one of the bits of feedback I get, Ross, and I'm sure it'll be part of the success of this radio station, is the public is just jack of a language of politics where everyone's making concessions, pulling their punches, not really saying what they think, talking in slogans driven by poll-driven data. You know, people have worked out that modern politics in the hands of an Albanese or a Chris Minns or a Dominic Perrottet is all about positioning and electoral fortunes rather than finding solutions to burning national and state problems. So I think that problem-solving focus that Trump has always had is something that we need to bring to Australian politics.
Yes, I think I would just overwhelmingly agree and endorse your appreciation for Trump's non-interventionist foreign policy. Indeed, in the end, I think he did get sort of rolled. He started out with greater conviction than he finished. For example, at the moment, he was dropping 50 Tomahawk missiles on Syria. But there is, I think, in Trump, partly because of the strength of his commercial background, a recognition that NATO is essentially a money laundering racket, and that it was it's a vestigial bureaucracy that may, what like one's appendix, it may once have had a purpose, but nobody really knows what it is now. And I guess what, one of the things it's sort of a little bit beyond our your remit in the New South Wales Parliament, but I note that the New South Wales Upper House under Don Harwin's presidency passed, I think, a unanimous resolution describing Donald Trump as a slug, is my recollection. I might have it wrong. What do you think in relation to Australia's foreign policy? I think it's fair to say that the what Eisenhower described as the military-industrial complex has had no closer partner in lubricating the racket.
Well, I think, Ross, that motion you mentioned describing Trump as a slug, one of my achievements in this term of Parliament was to have it revoked. It no longer stands on the books because we withdrew it through a majority upon my motion. And that level of disrespect to an American president was certainly inappropriate. It was, all, I think, a motion of the Greens back in the day, or one of their fellow travellers, to condemn Trump. But yeah, it's certainly true, the military establishment in this country, as in the United States, always needs an enemy. And they put their focus onto Russia. But truthfully, from an Australian perspective, you'd be more worried about China than Russia. And the NATO mistake post the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989 was to its failure to recognise that the Russian bear would always want a geopolitical buffer, a land buffer around the borders of Russia, and the encroachment and the aggressive nature of NATO has been a mistake. They needed, under the presidency of Bush the First, to provide that buffer to the Russian bear and try and settle all the European questions around it. Now, that failed, and the conflict in Ukraine, which has been an act of folly by Putin, he certainly made a mistake going in there, and his international reputation and domestic reputation have suffered. But it all comes out of a failure of judgment to be magnanimous and recognise the importance of a buffer for the Russian bear after the fall of the Berlin Wall. But this is essentially the work of the Americans, and Trump's point's always been the Americans fund NATO and are then expected to provide troops and military hardware to get NATO out of its problems. And I suppose to some extent we see that in the Ukraine today. So the Trump analysis of NATO was correct on that front, and also to tell them, quite frankly, that you clowns one day will end up dependent on Russian gas. And when that's cut off, all your prices will go through the roof and you'll start to deindustrialize. Well, they laughed at him at that point, but it was such a prescient prediction. He was 100% correct. And Trump's mastery of NATO is quite unparalleled in recent international affairs in terms of just getting everything right.
Yeah, well, you and I could have, I suspect, an interesting argument on Russia and China. But I'm going to put that on pause and perhaps return to it on your next visit to the show. But I suppose we should sort of do the chores and talk about the state of New South Wales, since it does have an election coming up on the 25th of March, since you are a candidate. What I would say that the defining Latham contribution in the New South Wales Parliament has been to drag the New South Wales Department of Education off some kind of a ledge of the most intense, crazy wokeness of virtually any bureaucracy in the country. It's an organisation that was described to me by one of its own senior executives as a lesbian Marxist collective. I think only half joking. Tell us, Mark, about your struggle to get the Department of Education focused on student outcomes, to give parents more access and influence to the educational process, and to try and avoid some of the excesses of ideology and dogma, which have replaced the traditional educational project in New South Wales.
Well, New South Wales has had the fastest falling school academic results in the world this century, not just Australia, the whole world. And it's been a complete disaster in terms of the prospects of our young people. And Ross, the great paradox in school education is that we know exactly what works in the classroom and exactly what doesn't work. The classroom is probably the most studied institution in any society. Education policy and outcomes, measurement have been analysed and studied inside out right around the world. Every country has a pile of education research studies that you can't jump over. So we know exactly what works. But the tragedy in New South Wales was we had this joker as Education Minister, Adrian Piccoli from the National Party, when the coalition was elected 12 years ago. And his policy was local schools, local decisions, which was basically what you're doing out there in the schools is not coordinated or focused centrally on the things that actually work in the classroom. As a school, just go off and do whatever you think matters. And this was at a time when the left-wing teaching establishment was going down the pathway of fads and experiments and political indoctrination. So it was the worst possible time to give them more freedom to deviate from the evidence base of what actually gets results for students in the classroom. And it was a complete and utter disaster. What should happen, and we've had partial success on this, but there's so much further to go, is that the Department of Education needs to define the core elements of what a school needs to be. For instance, in teaching methods, direct instruction, a teacher standing at the front of the classroom with a rich interchange of ideas with the students works a lot better than the teacher as facilitator, walking around with a cup of coffee while the students do so-called self-starting learning, which normally means one kid doing all the work off the internet while the teacher just acts as a facilitator. So you need to go to direct instruction as the pedagogy that works. So that should not be optional. That needs to be compulsory in every classroom in the state. So to behavioural standards, I mean, some of these classrooms are like a jungle, and without an orderly learning environment, it's impossible to learn. So we need the sorts of things that Catherine Burbelsing from Michaela College in London was talking about recently, where if you get the behavioural standards right, with no compromises and right, no concessions, right from the beginning of kindergarten through, you will have an orderly learning environment where every student can put their head down and actually absorb the information and knowledge. And then the third thing that stands out, of course, is the importance of early literacy. In New South Wales, each year we have 17,000 students who start high school semi-illiterate. It's a scandal that this is allowed to happen. And part of the reason is that in the experimental fads of teaching, they developed whole word literacy, the torture of trying to learn to read and write by understanding the whole word of vocabulary instead of phonics, sounding out the word. Mm. So one of my achievements was to suggest, and the government took it up, for the year one phonics check, so you can see whether the school is actually teaching the phonics in early literacy as opposed to the disastrous whole word. So, and there's other elements of what should happen in the classroom, but they're the core three: behavioural standards, direct instruction, and phonics in literacy, to make sure that the classroom is successful for the students. So, you know, all of that just sounds so logical and evidence-based. Who could be against it? The education department, you've got to get them dragged and kicking into this type of common sense. And they did abolish the local schools' local decisions, again, on my urging, but they haven't replaced it with the mandatory core elements of what we should all be doing in every single classroom across the state.
Mark, stay with us. We're going to go to a break in just a moment, come back hopefully with the benefit of your company. I'm going to invite listeners, if you are near a phone and have a pen or indeed your contacts folder open, I'm going to give you the talkback number for Australia, which is 1-800-670-310. 1-800-670-310. you're very welcome to give us a call in the next 20 minutes if it suits. And we will return with Mark Latham. We might have a discussion about energy in New South Wales and are we going to be able to keep the lights on and whatever else is happening inside his fertile mind. Ladies and gentlemen, you're on TNT Radio Live with Ross Cameron on The Ross Cameron Show.
Give me a minute with TNT Radio's Steve Malzberg.
Former San Francisco police officer Christopher Samayoa was on his fourth day on the job back in 2017 when he fatally shot a carjacking suspect named Keita O'Neill. That was during a police chase. The AP says O'Neill was suspected of assaulting a California lottery employee and stealing a van that belonged to the agency. The San Francisco DA at the time, Chesa Boudin, charged Samayoa with manslaughter and other charges in 2020, bragging that his decision was historic. Now, Boudin was one of those left-wing DAs who didn't much care for locking away all criminals. He was recalled by the voters last year, and his successor, Brooke Jenkins, says she will drop the manslaughter charge against Samayoa because she says it was politically motivated. You think? Samayoa became the first ever San Francisco police officer to be charged for an on-duty killing. Jenkins claims that her predecessor's handling of the case revealed internal conflicts, including filing the charges in a hurry just before the statute of limitations was set to expire for manslaughter. Bravo to Brooke Jenkins for righting a terrible wrong that could have gotten a lot worse. Thanks for giving me a minute. I'm Steve Malzberg for TNT Radio.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative. This is Viewpoint.
Anglo-American instigated regime change wars in recent decades have had a tragic outcome. Remember President George W. Bush's threat to Saddam Hussein in November 2002. If he refuses to disarm, then we will lead a coalition of the willing and disarm him. This threat was based on lies concocted under British Prime Minister Tony Blair that Saddam Hussein could unleash weapons of mass destruction in 45 minutes. More than 1 million Iraqis have died as a result of the conflict in their country since the US-led invasion in 2003. The Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs reports that as of 2021, 9.2 million Iraqis are internally displaced or refugees abroad. Regime change wars have left failed states, hotbeds of terrorism, and a refugee crisis not seen since World War II.
Driving the conversation, Ross Cameron on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
G'day, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, back with my guest, Mark Latham, who's running for election in the coming New South Wales upper house, March 25. I describe Mark Latham pound for pound as the highest value to citizens member of parliament in New South Wales. If I were to go to the lowest value, not with any pleasure, but for the sake of accuracy and balance, as a former member of the Liberal Party, I would have to say that Matt Keane is currently the most dangerous and destructive because I believe he is destroying energy security. But I'm happy for Mark Latham to take an alternative view. Give us your view on the push-me-pull-you Liberal-Keane-Perrottet government and its implications for the energy supply in New South Wales.
Well, Ross, we have forecast by AEMO and internal state government documents of the likelihood of blackouts after the closure of Eraring Power Station, the biggest in New South Wales, in 2025. And I asked Perrottet about this at the budget estimates. I said, we've got this looming economic and social disaster of blackouts as a product of the policies of your government, this rushed madcap scheme to go to 100% renewables within a decade that's forcing the established system to close down the coal-fired power stations. What are you doing to keep the lights on after 2025? And Perrottet said, I mean, it's hard to believe the negligence and the recklessness of this. He said, oh, I better get a briefing on that. I mean, Ross, if it's not urgent work, if it's not urgent work right now to have a policy to do the things needed to keep the lights on, and who'd invest in New South Wales? Who'd invest in manufacturing or retail or resources if we can't keep the electricity supply active? And Perrottet said, oh, I better get a briefing on that. And I followed up with a question on the newspaper to say, what did the briefing show you? And he referred me to a non-answer from Matt Keane. So New South Wales is in the appalling position for the election campaign. Neither Labor nor Liberal nor National Party, or of course nor the Greens, have got a policy for keeping the lights on in just 2 years' time after the closure of Eraring Power Station on the Lake Macquarie. So it's an appalling situation. The answer, of course, is we urgently need extra gas peaking plants. Our One Nation policy would be to build Bayswater 2 coal-fired power, but that takes too long. We've got a 2 or 3 year horizon to put extra generation capacity into the system. You can only really get that done with a new gas peaking plant. And our other longer term policy, of course, is to lift the New South Wales ban on uranium mining and nuclear power. Because let me just give you two fundamental facts, Ross, on the global scene about energy and climate change. Australia is the only country in the world, Australia is the only country in the world with the so-called rewiring the nation, which is costing tens of billions of dollars, and this is why the electricity bills are going up, to take the established system, which is coal-fired power, hooked up to a transmission grid essentially along the coast where the people live, and replace it with wind farms and solar farms that don't even run 24/7 in the western districts of the state, and then have to go to the cost of hooking them up into the electricity grid with transmission wires that run for hundreds and hundreds of kilometres. We're the only country in the world with the madness of that policy. And the other thing is, I don't agree with the net zero objective, but we're also the only country in the world thinking you can get to net zero carbon emissions without nuclear. I mean, we are the logical nuclear power with the uranium in the ground. We're geologically stable. We've got vast outback areas for waste disposal. And all you had to do was take the existing power stations if you wanted to replace the coal fired and have the new safe small modular reactors hooked into the transmission grid without all these extra costs of so-called rewiring the nation. Our policies at energy level with Perrottet, Keane, Chris Minns and the Greens are absolute insanity.
Mate, we're going to, because we believe in democracy and we think the citizens are smarter than the state, we open the talkback lines. We're going to take a very first caller. We're going to expose Mark Latham, unprotected, and myself. If it's a hard question, Mark can take it. If it's easy, I'll take it. Lou from Canberra is on the line. What have you got for us, Lou?
Good evening, gentlemen. How are you going?
Yeah, good.
Good, thanks, Lou. Very well.
All that's missing is some good rum and a cigar.
Well, it's radio. You don't really know what we've got.
Yeah, well, actually, I'm sitting at the back getting mauled by mosquitoes, but I'm watering my veggie patch, so it's okay. The things we do. But, Mark,
yep.
Sorry, mate, yeah?
No, fire away with your question, Lou. I'm all ears.
As a man, I sit here. I'm a father. I've raised four kids. The youngest, who's halfway through high school, I sit back and I look at the education system and the direction in which it's headed, and I can't understand, mate. This story time drag queen. You know, why is the target audience children? What? Where's the connection? Where's the relevance? Where are we going with this? What is the policy and the ideology behind this? I can't understand it, mate. I just, you know, I'm not being homo anything, phobic anything. Forgive me if I don't even know what the right term is. But I, as a man, mate, I sit back here. I don't know how I'd cope if I had to put my children through the education system again, especially the primary school and the high school. It's just toxic. I'm really sorry, guys. It's toxic.
No, don't be sorry. You've raised a legitimate concern.
It's toxic garbage. Yep. That's being fed to our kids.
Yeah, you've raised a legitimate concern. What is the left ideology? The left ideological objective here is to end the differences between male and female and to pretend to young people that gender is fluid, that a five-year-old boy can be a girl tomorrow and back to being a boy the day after. So that is the objective, which, of course, runs against biology and also social practice, that males and females are different. And I think it's a sick ideology. When you look at the Manly Library on the North Shore of Sydney running this drag Queen story time for three-year-olds, kids as young as three, saying, oh, they need to understand a tolerance about gender and sexuality. Well, for three-year-old children, they've got no understanding of gender and sexuality. It's not a relevant concern. Now, my attitude is when people become adults, they should have in a free society the right to, sort things out about gender and sexuality. But for children, it's a sick, sick practice to take three-year-old kids and have a drag queen story time with the objective of schooling them in so-called gender and sexuality tolerance. So it's completely inappropriate. And this stuff's also in our schools. One of the things I busted the government on last year was your Minor Beach Public School on the New South Wales Central Coast was running gender fluidity classes in year two. Year two, seven-year-old kids. And even worse, under Perrottet's policy, if the seven-year-old boy comes to school the next day and says, I'm a girl, he has the legal right under the education department to tell the school not to inform his parents. So it's the madness of allowing seven-year-olds to run the school and run their families. This stuff is sick, inappropriate, totally age inappropriate, and needs to end.
Lou, thanks for being our first caller. We appreciate it. Mark, I'm going to ask you before we lose you in another few minutes or so. I'm kind of giving you the Dorothy Dixer. The balance, it looks to me almost certain that there's going to be a Labor government in the lower house in New South Wales. Are we in agreement on that or not? You think there's some scope for an alternative result?
No, the Perrottet regime looks like it's out of ideas and out of time. You'd say they're asking for 16 years and the it's time factor will probably sweep them out, and that's what the polls indicate. So a lot of the focus comes to the upper house to see if we can have a handbrake on the extremes of a Labor-Green government alliance and policies like drug legalisation, gender fluidity, which we just mentioned with Lou, the mad rush to 100% renewables. I mean, these are things where you can't afford to have Labor and the Greens in total control of New South Wales, in control of both houses of parliament.
We could have the question of the balance of power in the upper house is really hanging out there in the breeze. It could go either way. I mean, I'm obviously championing the cause of John Ruddock and for the Liberal Democrats in the upper house. But I think we regard you as a very strong chance of winning indeed two seats, and you would say I think hopefully even three. What is just give us the current breakdown in the numbers in the upper house so people can understand how important it is that they get behind one of the Freedom candidates?
Well, say it's a Labor government, they'll need to provide a president. And then if they had 21 votes in the upper house out of the 41 votes on the floor, they'd have the numbers to get their legislation through, Chris Minns Labor-Green government. Labor currently has 14. The Greens are likely to end up with 5 and Animal Justice 2. So the arithmetic says that gives them 21, which is just one short of the numbers they need for both control of both houses of parliament. So the numbers are finally, finally balanced. And I would urge anyone with a cautious, common sense, conservative outlook on life to support parties like One Nation, also your Liberal Democrats, anyone on the crossbench who's right of centre, who would be an insurance policy or a handbrake on the extremes of a Labor-Green government. But One Nation, we've had a pretty good record over the last 4 years of doing things in a common sense, purposeful way. The track record we have on energy policy, on education, cost of living speaks for itself. So I'm hoping we get some good support, but I hope most of all that the Labor-Green Animal Justice forces don't have the 22 votes they need to control all of New South Wales politics, and that I think is very dangerous for the state.
Mark, you've struck a nerve on the education and schooling question. We like you go straight to meat and three veg. We've got Tony from Palm Beach on the Gold Coast, also wants to raise a question and make a comment about schooling. Take it away, Tony.
Yeah, how you going, fellas? I'm a long-time listener of you both, and I always admired you guys, so it's a great privilege for me to talk to you, especially on your first night, Ross, so excellent. But I do have a question for Mark, as he is a great champion of education, and I know it's more sort of focused on New South Wales than I am from Queensland, but it sort of goes across all of the schooling, I think. And one of the things that I have come across lately with my son, he's at a school that is on the south of the Gold Coast, and in a recent year during NAIDOC week, all of the students in his grade, which was grade 3 at the time, were given a piece of paper, and it was titled Always Was and Always Will Be. And their whole grade had to write a short story. This is grade 3s, and I think it might have been the grade 4s as well, on why that statement was what it was and what it meant to them. And so it was always was and always will be. And I considered that to be quite confronting, to be expecting a 8 or 9 year old to be, first of all, trying to comprehend such a statement, because I think it's quite a heavy statement to say that basically because he's got a certain colour of skin that it's not his country and it never will be. So I just wanted to ask, you know, your opinion on that, Mark, and what sort of damage that kind of thing's doing in schooling, if that's what they're focused on.
Well, Tony, you raise a really good point, because the first thing is it's age inappropriate. As you say, Indigenous and other land tenure is not something you normally teach in year 3 of primary school, and the priority there should be literacy, that children like yours and others can read and write, do comprehension, numbers. That's got to be the overwhelming priority instead of political propaganda. In terms of the slogan, and that's all it is, always was, always will be Aboriginal land, well, it defies the legal framework of the Mabo decision some 30 years ago, legislated by the Parliament and accepted by just about everyone now, that there's a legal framework by which this question of Indigenous land rights is determined, that they must have an ongoing affinity and association and use of the land. So there's no point saying, Tony, your property or my property or Ross's home always was and always will be Indigenous land. Under the law of Australia, it's a false statement. It's a falsehood. It's a propaganda being taught in our schools. And it also wipes other important landowners who've contributed. I live on a property in the southwest of Sydney, for instance, which was once the calf farm of the MacArthur family, who established the modern wealth of our nation through the merino and sheep farming and the like. And when they do the acknowledgement of country, I always think and say to myself, well, I'll acknowledge the MacArthur family, who 200 years ago owned the land that I live on and did a lot to establish the wealth and prosperity of our nation. So let's put all this in perspective. This whole Indigenous thing, which isn't helping Indigenous people, who in many places like Alice Springs and the west of New South Wales are in an absolute quagmire of problems. It's not helping them to propagandise about land rights.
My son either, because where does he fit into that? If it's not his land and it never will be, then he's Anglo-Saxon, obviously. Where does he fit in?
Well, and he doesn't have to fit anywhere. He needs to learn numbers and literacy and writing skills. And if he wants to sort out a particular view about Indigenous issues, I'm sure he can do that as an adult and vote accordingly.
Yeah, excellent. Very good.
Well, Marcus, you're a good encouragement to us. Thanks for calling in. You've been part of history. No doubt the Smithsonian in the United States will be recording and playing this to every visitor in generations to come. So well done.
I do hope so. I hope the man from who was around in 161 to 180 AD would be proud of the discussion tonight.
Oh, you're a top bloke.
Yeah, well done. Well said
about him too.
But I'll hang in here, Ross. I want to listen to your discussion with Nigel Farage, who I admire very much, and I regard the Cameron Farage partnership as one of the delights of current international affairs.
Well, you're very kind, Mark. Love to have you hanging around for it. We're excited about it. We are going to give. I think. We actually have a Marcus who is on the callback, who we're not going to go to until after the break. We've got a hard break, I'm told, by Alex, our producer, at the top of the hour. But we are going to certainly get to the great Marcus Aurelius, the one and only, the inspiration. And we might even touch on him in the next hour. But tell us, if I may, what are what do you like, Marcus, from Melbourne? What do you like about Nigel Farage in the 30 seconds we've got to go? Sorry, I think we might have lost. I think we might have lost Marcus from Melbourne. There we go. Yeah. So we've got the great man himself. He's moved the dial of history. He's a unique figure in modern politics, and we'll have Nigel to look forward to when we come back from this break.